Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Good afternoon and happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. We haven't been here in a while.
It's true. I took a couple Tuesdays off and you took a summer off.
Yes,
and,
I did.
It's been a while.
I know. Nice to see you.
You too. You look far away.
I feel far away. But, you know, I have a lot on my mind, which I do, I think, every Tuesday when I get here. My brain is spinning because I want to make sure that I can fit in everything I want to talk about. And, of course, it's getting to that time where Cal Poly is starting up again in a couple of weeks. So I'm putting together my syllabi. For the quarter, and I'm thinking about trigger warnings and how they fit into my material and how they fit into the college campus. And I'm thinking about anxiety and how we have 90% of our students who are out on homestay in public education are home because of anxiety, not because of real sicknesses or injuries, but because they're anxious about being at school. And so I've been thinking a lot about this connection between childhood anxiety and the need for the idea that we need trigger warnings on campuses now to protect students from being triggered on campus. So those things are kind of brewing around in my head. And I'm also thinking about how lucky I am, fortunate I am, to be able to come in every Tuesday and talk about these things, to have a forum and a place to bring up these issues, because I don't think there are a lot of media outlets that are willing to talk about, to counter the story that's told by the mainstream about what anxiety is and what trigger warnings are for and what medications do. You know, we have that mainstream story. There aren't many outlets that are willing to say, yeah, but should we really be trusting what the experts are telling us? And I get to come in every Tuesday and kind of tell that other side of the story. And so I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about Pledge Drive and the fact that I get to come in and do this every Tuesday and I get to share this information and these stories with you because of public support, because of listener support for this station, for this show, for my my stories each week, my conversations. So it's Pledge Drive, right?
It is Pledge Drive. We're going to try to make it short. We've scheduled it for 9 days. We started last Friday and we're hoping to wrap up by Saturday at 5 o'clock. Short and sweet. And that's because we had a large number of support from people who mailed in their renewals, you know, pledged before the drive actually started. Plus, we're getting more and more people that choose to be sustainers. And I'm sure you know what that means, but that means you've made a commitment, a monthly commitment, to X dollars per month. And it's entirely up to you. $2, $5, $10, $20 a month that never expires. You know, it's not an annual pledge. It's an ongoing pledge until you tell us to stop. And that way you as a supporter don't have to worry about, is it my time to renew? And you know that you're making a meaningful ongoing contribution to KCBX. And if you ever move or get disillusioned or whatever reason decide, there's no obligation to keep it going, but it's just one less thing to worry about. You know, it's like your other things, you have automatic payment, your cable bill or perhaps your mortgage or something else that just automatically you budget for it and you know what's going to happen, but you don't really have to think about it.
Maybe it's going to see your therapist.
Possibly.
And instead of spending the money out there, you get your therapist here on Tuesdays with me. So just go to kcbx.org and you can pledge right there. It's probably the easiest because I want to make sure we can open up the phone lines here and talk to you today. So we'd really appreciate you making a pledge. It shows a direct support for the show. They like to get the feedback about how you feel about this program every Tuesday. So kcbx.org.
There's actually two phone numbers. You can call, if you're making a pledge, it's 549-8855 and then Elizabeth has the other number that rings directly into the studio here, which is a 781-3875. So you can call too. Just keep the number separate.
now we're giving it, we're making
yeah,
it.
Yeah, too complicated.
Yeah, too complicated.
KCBX.org works.
Well, thank you for supporting the show and thanks for being in here today, Hank. And let's talk about trigger warnings and anxiety and how we got to this place where as a instructor, as an educator, I need to worry about trigger warnings in my classroom. That's good to hear the phones ringing in the background here. So if you aren't familiar with what a trigger warning is, it's a statement at the start of a piece of writing or before a video starts or before a lecture begins, alerting the readers or the students or the viewers to the fact that what they're going to hear or see may contain potentially distressing material. So I would think that in my classroom, because I teach family psychology and helping relationships and a lot of things that have to do with our personal lives and our responses and our emotions, that for a lot of students, what they're going to hear when they're in my classroom might trigger them feeling discomfort, or it might remind them of bad experiences they had when they were young or situations they had in their family that make them uncomfortable. Well, basically, to be honest, I should trigger warning my show every week because I hope that I'm bringing information in some ways that might make you feel a little dissonant, a little uncomfortable, so that it causes you to check your gut and say, is the what I'm doing helping to support my mental health and well-being? Is the way I'm living, is the way I'm parenting, the way I'm loving my spouse, you know, am I living my life in such a way that is in my well-being, or am I depending on others? So this idea of trigger warnings has become in some ways controversial. I think it was kind of flared up by Jay Ellison. He's the dean of students at the University of Chicago. And he made national news. It's been all over. And it was last year also that it came up. The University of Chicago has really been on the cutting edge of this idea of trigger warnings. But Jay Ellison actually said he informed the incoming freshmen this year that the school is committed to academic freedom and does not support trigger warnings, because the concern was that if students were uncomfortable with the material they were hearing their professors present, that they might file Title IX complaints or harassment complaints, or, you know, go and challenge actually the freedom of speech or the academic freedom that professors have to share information that might not always be comfortable. So Jay Ellison's response to trigger warnings saying they do not support them fueled a debate with other professors in different parts of the country, some who feel it's really important to be sensitive to the students. Some other presidents of universities have come out talking about safe spaces. So it started kind of this national debate about, you know, what is our responsibility as college professors or the university to protect the emotional well-being of students? Also, the question is, what is our responsibility as young adults to care for ourselves? I guess kind of what ruminates in my head a lot along with this is, you know, the main job we have as parents is to raise our children to become adults. And part of the task of becoming an adult is to be able to cope with and navigate uncomfortable situations. And so I think that kind of drives this idea of the trigger warnings is, you know, our students are going to be uncomfortable when they hear material that doesn't align with what they were told when they were young. Growing up is, you know, to protect them, to make them feel safe, to make them feel comfortable. And all of a sudden they get to college and they're, you know, hearing counter information and it triggers them feeling anxious or feeling uncomfortable. You know, at what point are we going to help our children become young adults if they get to college and they still don't have the coping skills to deal with uncomfortable information? So, I guess the thing that's interesting is that this current movement on college campuses, to me, is really a reflection of the epidemic of anxiety and depression and medication use by college students that we see on campuses all over the country. It reflects, you know, these ridiculous expectations and pressures that we put on students today to achieve. But it's also, in many ways, a reflection of, I don't know, maybe deplorable is too heavy of a word, but the deplorable state of our mental health at this time, our mental health profession, that we really have not done a good job of preparing young people for the stress and pressures of adulthood. So I guess I want to focus today on, you know, where we are as a mental health profession and how we have in some ways perpetrated this epidemic of depression and anxiety and put us in a place where we feel like we need to have trigger warnings on college campuses. And so just to stir it up a little bit, let me say that I think what we're seeing is the result of the growth of our mental health industry. In really not helpful ways, you know, that we have gone from being a talk therapy centered profession to now being, you know, attached to the medical profession where we medicate first and then we ask questions later. Much of our mental health protocol is about taking a normal life event like stress or grief or anxiety related to fears and pathologizing it. As a profession, we've gone from normalizing the human experience to elevating much of our human experience to the level of chronic disorder or syndrome. We've labeled, we've diagnosed, we've grown the DSM. And so what was once, you know, this safe place, therapy, which was once this safe space itself, what they're calling for on college campuses to create this safe space. The idea of the therapeutic container originally was to create this safe space where people could come in, sort out their feelings, their emotions, their experiences without judgment, receiving unconditional positive regard, receiving support and empathy until they were able to work out the feelings they were having of distress and discomfort and get back to the job of their daily living. This space, this profession now really has in some ways become the source of the wounding for many. Many who've come in for comfort to talk about something that's stressful or upsetting, and then they've left this experience feeling fragile, feeling crazy, feeling sick, feeling condemned to a life now of prescription medications to deal with emotional problems. You know, the helping professions itself, and remember, I'm speaking from that place of being one of them. We've triggered this need for trigger warnings because we've convinced so many of the worried well. And I use that term specifically because the vast majority of people who come in for therapy, we consider the worried well. That's what we call them in the trades. There are people that are, you know, struggling with communication issues or personal dilemmas or parenting issues or grief or loss. You know, those are normal life experiences that we struggle with, and we are overall well. You might be overall doing just fine, going to work, managing your household, but you have this worry, this concern, this event that's happening that you need help with. So we've, in a way, convinced the worried well that they are actually incapable of withstanding the suffering or the sorrow that comes with a normal adult life. We've convinced the worried well that they're actually sick. And the result of our helping profession's inability to actually sit with our clients' pain the way we were trained to let them know that, you know, we can't fix or change anything that's happened in your life. Everything that happens in our lives is part of our personal story, and that can't be changed. But what we can do is witness this pain, witness this experience, help to look at options or opportunities for growth and change. But ultimately, you know, when we are suffering and struggling as individuals, we have to live through that suffering. We have to find the resilience, the coping skills, the fortitude to live through our suffering to come out the other side. And a good therapist kind of holds that space to support the individual as they struggle through to come out the other side. But we've actually created a world of adults who are struggling to deal with their own emotional development. And, you know, it's because we've lied to our clients in some way. We've maybe sold this story that you can come in and leave feeling better or feeling great or being alleviated of all suffering in your life, but that's not true. The truth of the matter is, if you've ever read a disclosure form when you go in for therapy, one of the things we tell you right off the bat is that in working with these emotions or these feelings or this experience you're having, you will more than likely feel worse at the beginning than you did when you came in. Because when you really kind of open up that suitcase of experiences, you're going to feel more discomfort kind of looking around at your emotional baggage, your emotional life, and having to kind of live in those feelings again and experience them than you did when you first walked in. But But the hope is that if we can sit with these emotions, these bad feelings, dig around in that suitcase of emotional history that's bogging you down, that's wearing you down, that ultimately will provide the space where you're able to repack that suitcase of your life, maybe squish down everything, take the vacuum, you know, and flatten all of the worries or the loss or the pain and put them back in the suitcase to make room for new experiences and new opportunities in your life. Because what bogs us down is that when we're dragging emotional baggage that we can no longer carry with us, it makes it difficult to get on with the tasks of daily living. So the wonder of talk therapy was to have someone sit and witness this story of your life, to open up the trunk that is your emotional life and have someone sort through it with you and make sense of it or accept, help you accept it or help you, you know, navigate through, find coping skills, and then to repack that suitcase and carry on. But we failed. In a lot of ways, we failed to tell the truth to our clients. And so where we've gotten to is a place where we have a lot of adults who have been led to believe that they need to have their prescription or their medication or their therapist in order to function day in and day out, that they are actually emotionally fragile. And then these emotionally fragile adults are depending on experts and professionals to tell them how to live and how to get by. And then these same fragile adults who are putting their hands in the, you know, their lives in the hands of experts and professionals are also turning their children over to mental health professionals. They're turning their children's whole well-being over to the same professionals, expecting that they, you know, the professionals must know much more than they do as parents. And so as professionals, we now have children in vast numbers. 5% of the population, you know, is considered, 1% is actually considered to have a diagnosable mental disorder that is chronic. And 5% of children can have some sort of adjustment disorder. But we're seeing 15 to 18% of our population. So a good 13 to 14% of our population are being seen by experts and professionals, being diagnosed, labeled, medicated, taught that they're fragile, who don't need that intervention. And so what happens for children is that they, with well-intended parents, you know, send their child to a therapist who tells the parent the child has adjustment disorder or anxiety disorder or ADHD, you know, there's maybe bipolar disorder. You know, we're diagnosing children as young as 2 and 3 with bipolar disorder. This whole array of diagnoses can come about. And so before the child's even in pre-K or transitional kindergarten, they now have a educational label folder in their label in their folder that's going to stay with them all the way through their education. And so this changes the way the child thinks about themselves. It changes the way the education system reacts to this child. And here's where it relates to today's college campus, is that when these children who were diagnosed when they were young move from college, right, they graduate from high school, they're not graduating from their baggage that they've been carrying since childhood. They're not graduating from their diagnosis. They're not graduating from their feelings of anxiety or depression. They're not graduating with the coping skills necessary or the resilience necessary to deal with the demands of adult life. And so they're coming to these college campuses with all the desires and drives of adulthood at 18 to 22, but a lot of them don't have any responsibilities of young adulthood. They haven't had responsibilities growing up. They were kind of coddled or treated as if they were fragile. And so they haven't had to really learn resilience or grow their independence or learn responsibility, and whether it's from emotional caretaking to financial caretaking. And they go in with the same desires as adults, but no responsibilities and none of the emotional strength that they need to work in the adult world. So here we are, you know, in college. And now we have a lot of students who are for the first time hearing information that is uncomfortable, that might be frightening. Again, in my class, as you can imagine, in family psychology, I'm going to talk about medicating children and the dangers of, you know, long-term untreated anxiety and depression. And for a lot of my students who have been on medication since they were young, it makes them uncomfortable. Because what do we do with the terror we feel when we find out that something we've been doing for a long time is ultimately not good for us? So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you are welcome to be part of the conversation. As always, my number is 805-781-3875. I wanted to talk about anxiety, trigger warnings. How do we find out information that actually is going to be helpful to us? How do we know who we can trust in the medical professions or in the professional world in general? How do we trust that the information we're getting is actually in our best interest? Or should we trust that the information we're getting is actually in our best interest? Or should we be cynical about everything? But then what does that set us up for is kind of just feeling anxious and worried out on our own. So how do we find the right supportive help that we need in the times that we need it? 805-781-3875. You can also be part of our conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can follow us on our Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist, and you can always send me an email to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com. So I want to talk a little bit about the trust part and the professionals, because this has kind of been a theme all summer. Is every person, you know, that I've talked to who has fundamentally changed their life in some way, from the artist in South Dakota to the street musician to the organic farmer in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, they all had a similar story. Even my very conservative city councilman in Louisville, Kentucky, each one of them said the same thing to me about the beginning of the change in their life, which was, when I finally realized that everything I learned was not true, I then began to change my life for the better. And so there seems to be two lives that many people live. One is the one we're taught through our traditional education system, through our traditional parenting styles, through our American dream story, right? There's that one path. And then there's this other path that veers away the other direction that kind of questions all of these state institutions or these belief systems that we followed that sets us up for a different understanding of life and health and well-being. So let me give you a couple examples. 15% of high school students today are medicated for ADHD. That is 3.5 million high school students. That's up from 600,000 high school students that were medicated in 1990. What's interesting about this statistic is that it actually coincides, this growth from 600,000 to 3.5 million in 2013, it coincides with a two-decade-long marketing campaign by Big Pharma to promote pills to doctors and educators and parents to manage ADHD symptoms. Now, remember, ADHD still does not have a medical test that it can follow. Historically, according to ADHD experts, the legitimate amount of ADHD cases we should see is 5% across the student population. The reason I bring this up is because this growth from 600,000 to 3.5 million in medicated students was led by Dr. Joseph Biederman, who received $1.6 million in consulting and speaking fees by the pharmaceuticals. And he went out and spoke to doctors and psychiatrists all over the country, lauding the benefits of these medications. Dr. Biederman happened to be a professor and researcher at Harvard University. I bring up this story because yesterday in the New York Times was a story about the sugar industry, and that in 1967, the Sugar Research Foundation, or the Sugar Association as they're known today, paid three Harvard scientists to publish a review that minimized the link between sugar and heart health and demonized saturated fat as being the sole cause of heart illness. And this led to the now four decades of the low-fat, high-fructose corn syrup binge diet we've been on, the rise in diabetes and obesity, not to mention that gut inflammation and mood disorder connection we've been talking about the last couple weeks. So the sugar industry basically paid off these Harvard scientists to minimize the negative effects of sugar in our systems, leading in some ways to what we see in our mood disorders and our health issues. And what's even more distressing is that one of those Harvard scientists went on to be the head of nutrition at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and helped to draft the 1977 dietary guidelines that we've been following or were followed at that time. So who do you trust? I mean, how if Harvard is considered one of our leading, you know, research institutions, and these are two different stories of different research that has impacted our health and well-being, then doesn't that make you wonder about everything you've been told to be true? The other issue is that how do you cope with the distress you're feeling right now, the panic that arises when you realize maybe that you've been faithful to a plan or a theory or diagnosis that actually may have been more harmful to you than helpful? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation today. Hi, Janine, you're on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, Janine, are you there? I'm not hearing Janine. So we'll get back to her. Janine, can you call? Hold on 1 second. Call back in. So the reason I bring up the research and the idea of questioning what the experts tell us is that I'm going to go back to what we see when it comes to diagnosing anxiety in children. Because not that anxiety is the only thing that is distressing college students or making them uncomfortable or making them feel they need trigger warnings when they hear uncomfortable information. It may be not just anxiety, but anxiety is underneath every sort of mental health concern that we have. It somehow leads in there, that first response from our very primal nervous system that sets off that fight or flight response where our palms get sweaty or our mouth gets dry or we get uncomfortable. That first response is kind of that anxious response. It's a very normal biological response that we have to things that are uncomfortable. So I want to talk about how anxiety plays into trigger warnings, because it's the most common mental health concern that people come into therapy for. And as I said, 90% of children that are out on homestay are out because of anxiety-related issues and not illness or injury of some kind. And so anxiety and dealing with anxiety is an epidemic in our culture. Our ability to deal with or not deal with anxiety is an epidemic. And I think one of the reasons it's such an issue is because we went from being a culture that talked about worries and being a worrier to taking those same symptoms and calling them a chronic disorder or disease. And that was the slippery slope that made anxiety one of the most commonly diagnosed disorders we see today. So let's try back with Janine. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, sorry about that. What's on your mind?
You know, it was so interesting to listen to the reluctant therapist talking about, I'm a professional organizer, and I noticed that when you're dealing with people's physical issues, it's exactly the same. If a person doesn't do a first initial cleanup and they delegate that to someone else, then they never are able to learn with the anxiety of dealing with life and then just maintaining it in, you know, its best potential state. And so I've noticed that what the reluctant therapist is saying is so interesting, because in the same way health and well-being issues are being delegated to, let's just say, medicine or psychotropic drugs, they're not being dealt with. People are not learning the coping skills. They're not going through a period of anxiety where they're addressing it and can learn to overcome those things and can learn to maintain healthy lives in which they are able to deal with low-level anxiety and be able to maintain it in a lower state and be successful in life.
And Jean, that's so well said, because that was going to be my next point, was that worries, things that start off as worries or normal anxieties that are undealt with or we don't learn to manage, can become disorders down the road. And so I would imagine, as an organizer, someone who has, you know, a messy bedroom that starts to feel overwhelming can become a hoarder household because it just takes off.
Precisely. And it's so interesting, because that day that you sit down with them and say, we are doing this, you're going to feel anxiety, and in 2 or 3 days, you'll be a different person and you'll be able to live life differently. There will still be a tremendous amount of anxiety, but once they clean up their own mess and go ahead and address that, learn that they can do it, and then learn the habits of maintaining that, then dealing with anxiety, having worries, those are things that they learn that they can do something about instead of delegating it to somebody else and saying, I'm putting this off, I can't do this, maybe I'll self-harm instead, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Well said. You know, and the other part of the whole idea of managing anxiety is I'm listening to you talk, because it's always nice to hear someone else kind of saying what I'm thinking. I hear the pushback being, but we don't want people to feel anxious and uncomfortable, right? We're afraid that if we push someone to feeling too much anxiety or too much stress, they might commit suicide, or they might really flip out, or they might really get sick. And so I think from a professional standpoint, a lot of therapists are concerned about pushing too far and tipping someone the other way. And I think that that fear of pushing someone too far has held people in this place of sickness and kind of held us hostage, actually, as professionals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yet, you mentioned children being diagnosed with illnesses that will follow them through life, whereas, you know, when someone is young, that's the perfect time to be able to say, this is a training period, this is an education period, and if we don't do this education right now, we don't address this like we would teach them math or reading or language, then of course they're going to have problems later on down the road. Of course, if you simply smack a label on them and say they can't do it, they're going to have problems later on down the road.
Well said, Janine. Thank you for taking the time to call.
Thank you so much. Have a good afternoon.
You too. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Today we're talking about trigger warnings in colleges and my feeling that we're seeing this sprout up all over our country because of the work we're not doing with children when they go into elementary school and through high school and junior high. We're not doing the work of helping them manage and deal with scary, strong, overwhelming emotions, anxiety, worries, whatever that is, normalizing these struggles when they're young. And we're getting these kids up to college age and they have no coping skills to deal with the realities of life. And I think it's also a reflection on a lot of adults who have kind of handed their lives to therapists, to experts who are trying to help, but are indeed in many ways doing more harm than good. And I'm curious to know what you think about this. Does this resonate with you on any level? Or does this make you feel dissonance? Does this make you feel anxious hearing that maybe the way you've been parenting or coping or not coping is actually harming you and is not helpful? I'd love to hear from you. 805-781-3875 is our number. And we're going to come back and take your calls. But for a moment, we're going to talk about your opportunity to join the pledge drive.
Yes, you as KCBX listeners have a very big part of the KCBX station, and the way we do our work here is because we rely on listener support from you guys through donations. If you would like to donate to KCBX, help support the Reluctant Therapist here, go to kcbx.org and you can go to the Support KCBX tab. You can place your pledge there. It'll be all great. There's lots of different opportunities. You can win a trip to Italy and the south of France even. You're entered through every donation counted is one entry into that particular drive. So if you wanted, you could support your programs here at KCBX and go to Europe if you want.
And that'd be good for your mental health and well-being, absolutely.
Oh, yes.
KCBX.org is to make your pledge of support. And again, you know, this show is incredibly unique because there are very few media outlets that are going to talk about mental health in this way. Because most media outlets are commercial. They're supported by commercial entities that have a stake in pushing their programs or their plans or their medications. And so you're going to be limited in the information that you hear by the constraints of that commercial radio station and what they get to share with you. And so I feel so lucky to be able to talk to you about the more broader aspect of mental health and well-being and how it impacts us all and how we can be the drivers in our mental health and how we don't have to hand over our well-being to experts and professionals and believe that they really have the answers for us. And I want to say this carefully because, again, I'm talking about my profession, something I've proudly been a part of for 20 plus years. I believe that most of the people in my profession come to this with a great heart for wanting to help others. I think the challenge is that the profession itself has become an industry. And the way that we're training young professionals that are coming through schools, or the way that we're changing our educational units and our protocols as therapists, and this kind of call from our managed care, our insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, corporations, what they're wanting from us as professionals is to get people patched back up and put back into their cubicle so that they can work. And so that kind of pressure on a profession makes it very difficult for the profession to remain autonomous and to do the work that we really know in our heart is best for our clients. So I'm not trying to disparage my fellow professionals in any way. I do get concerned that my fellow professionals also bite in, you know, drink the Kool-Aid much too quickly about new ideas and interventions and things that are proven to cut corners or make it easier to bypass, or even buying into the Kool-Aid that we're somehow supposed to try to be happy all the time, or that we should never suffer, or that grief should be over in 6 weeks. You know, my fellow professionals can't, if we buy into that idea, if we forget what we actually know, which is that grief takes 1 to 5 years to overcome, and that postpartum takes at least 6 months to reconcile, that women need at least 6 months to have their bodies and their hormones fall back into some sort of place of normalcy. If we buy into the idea that we can shortcut the normal adult processes of coping, then we are doing a disservice to our clientele who are coming to us hoping that we're going to be able to help them with something that they're struggling with. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. Love to know your thoughts on the state of anxiety in the world and this idea of trigger warnings on campus. Do you feel like it's important? Do we need to trigger warning? Should I trigger warning this show every week and tell you ahead of time what I'm going to talk about so that you don't feel discomfort? How long is it our job as professionals to prepare people for feeling uncomfortable? And when do we have the responsibility for being able to manage our responses to things that make us uncomfortable? It's interesting because I remember growing up, so, you know, I was the worrier kid in my family from the time I was very young. I can remember always worrying. My first worry that I remember was going on a trip with my parents. I was probably five. And my dad was packing up, you know, the suitcases, putting them in the car. And I had this round suitcase that I loved. And he was tying it on the roof of the car. I was like, Dad, don't put it on the roof of the car. It's going to fall off. It's going to roll away. And he's like, nah, you're fine. It's like, no, really. I don't want it up there. And my stomach was going to knot. And I was so nervous about it. And my gut saying no. And sure enough, we're driving up the Bayshore Freeway, a half hour from our house. And there goes my little round suitcase off the back of the car, starts rolling down the street. Now, when my worry was not misguided, something did happen. My gut was telling me. And so what's the learning lesson in here? You know, to not ever worry, or that my worry was unfounded, or that I should never be a worrier? Or was really the lesson that when you feel uncomfortable and things happen that happened and you feel like you're out of control, how do you manage those feelings, right? How do I, as a five-year-old or a six-year-old, start to learn the skills? Because I couldn't, overcome my dad's authority in that issue or that moment, but how would I learn to grow my own resolve or my coping skills when my stomach starts to feel uncomfortable or I start to feel my chest pounding or start to feel anxious? And did I overcome it at 5 or 6? Absolutely not. I had spent a long part of my childhood and into my early adulthood kind of watching these worries grow or change or become different kinds of anxieties and dealing with those feelings. And the most interesting thing I think about my experience as an anxious child or a worrying child is that the best advice I got through, even going through and getting my master's and working 20 years in the field was something my dad told me when I was young, which was you'll outgrow most of these anxieties rather than ever fix any of them. And he was right. My temperament has been my temperament my whole life. That has been unchanged. But how I work with my temperament, how I design my life around my temperament has been the key in providing me with the healthiest life possible for me at this point. And I think that's where we as parents really have to focus. Instead of, you know, looking at our worried or anxious child who's coming to us saying, I'm nervous about a test, or I'm nervous about school, or I'm nervous about my friends, or whatever those, or I woke up and I had a bad dream. We as parents are the first line of defense. We have to be the ones to be confident enough that our child is fine. We have to be confident knowing these are normal feelings that children have. And as parents, if we're confident in knowing that our child's reaction is normal for the situation, then we can say in all confidence, you know what, I know this feels scary, or I know this feels overwhelming, and let's do some breathing to help calm down your heart from racing so fast, or to help you, you know, let's get a drink of water. And when we can start to get your breath calm down and your heart not beating so fast, we can talk about some ways to maybe make the test taking a little less scary, or we can talk about some things you can do at school when you start to feel overwhelmed. But if parents start to react with anxiety when their child comes to them and says, I'm feeling anxious, then we now get into this loop of anxiety that can really start to grow worries into bigger issues. When we look at research about anxiety, you know, much of anxiety is in our temperament. Some people have a high-wired, anxious temperament, and some are pretty relaxed and mellow. And some of these anxious responses are inherited. About 30% of our anxiety response is inherited or genetic. But it's not the disorder that is inherited. OCD is not inherited. Chronic anxiety is not inherited. It's the temperament or the predisposition towards that kind of anxiety, which is inherited. And then what kind of kicks us into the anxiety loop is when we see our parents, or we take in our parents responding with anxiety, because we're learning, children are learning all day long from those adults that they're in contact with. And so when something frightening happens and the parents kind of flip out, then the child learns, oh, I feel that flip out too. I think I'll escalate my feelings, and we get into this loop. So our first line of defense in helping our children cope with and deal with worries is to, as a parent, understand what are the normal reactions or normal things that children are going to encounter in life, and how can we help them to deal with those things. It's funny because I was looking at books that are used to help children overcome anxiety when they're young, and both of the trainers talk about worries. When my worry gets too big, or worrying too much. When my worry gets too big is actually a relaxation book that can be used with children. It's still a workbook to go through. And this is the key piece, is that if we can handle and help young children address worries as normal when they're young, then they start to develop these coping skills. It's like, oh, I was really nervous about that test, and yet I closed my eyes and I took some breaths and I squeezed a little worry rock in my pocket and I was able to do the test. It wasn't the best test ever, but it was okay. And then the next time they're faced with something that's kind of scary, overwhelming, they have a few coping skills to work with. And as you know, the older we get, the bigger those worries can be. We can grow into worries about our employment, or worry about our relationships, or worry about the environment, or worry about, our mortality. I mean, worries grow and grow. So when will we learn those coping skills? And when will we trust that we actually, even though we think we're going to die from fear and anxiety, be able to cope and get through to the next event? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. And again, maybe no one's anxious but me. maybe I'm the only person that experiences these things. And maybe the whole idea of trigger warnings isn't important. I don't know. I'm curious to know what you think about this. 805-781-3875. You know, Bree, you're fresh out of college. Yeah. Did they trigger warning in Montana?
They did for my women's and gender studies class, but that was the only one that, I think it was probably the only one that was really necessary too, that talked about those deep subjects and sometimes more violent subjects that some people in the class might have experienced. And so talking about those might trigger those feelings in them. And so there was a trigger warning before those classes, but other classes, not so much. I mean, I guess some of my journalism classes, we did talk about some disturbing things, but I think that's also just a part of the profession too. You have to deal with things that are a little more disturbing sometimes, and for those real life experiences, you don't have trigger warnings for those, you know.
So do you feel that the trigger warnings you did experience in the women's studies class, were they helpful? I mean, was that...
I think it was for some people. It really depends on the person and their reaction to those different types of things. Every person's different. You know, some people need a trigger warning. Some people don't. Some people get triggered by other things. You know, it also leaves room for people to the expectation of dealing with an issue the way you want to. Like, if you want to set out a class that you have permission to do so, like in other classes you can't skip, you'll get marked down for it.
Mm-hmm.
But
so a trigger warning actually gives you permission to leave the classroom.
That's in some instances. I remember my professor said that you know, we're going to be talking about, say, like domestic violence or something like that, and if this is something that's hard for you to hear about or talk about, you don't have to come to class today if you don't want to. It's not required.
Well, and it's interesting because I guess, you know, maybe I'm too old school of a therapist, but I wonder at some point we're going to have to sit with that discomfort in order to let the discomfort find some place in us, right? Because,
right.
Because it's never going to go away. If you've experienced domestic violence or you've experienced trauma, it lives within your body forever. And so learning how to live in, I don't know if it's harmony is the right word. That's probably minimizing it completely. But to live with the facts of our life in some way. Mm-hmm. And that it seems that the more empowering thing to do, right, is to take action. Because most of the what I think is really helpful anxiety training comes in the form of not managing or fighting anxiety or avoiding anxiety, but actually like listening to the anxiety. When the symptoms come up, be really curious, like, what is my body trying to tell me? It goes back to the whole gut and inflammation and trusting, you know, our gut, that our gut and that nerve center, if we're feeling anxious, it's telling us something. Mm-hmm. For a reason. So what is it it's trying to tell me? What should I do with this information? Or how, you know, should I process how I'm feeling in the moment, not try to avoid it, but kind of go with it? And then the other piece is to take action. There's always a take action, right? The first is to accept, oh, I'm feeling uncomfortable right now. My palms are sweating, my heart is racing, or I'm feeling like I can't get out of bed, to kind of acknowledge those feelings. And the second step is to take action of some kind. And the taking action point becomes kind of the empowering piece of the taking charge of our life. And so for someone who's experienced domestic violence or sexual assault or even, you know, death or loss or grief, to be able to do something with that death and loss and grief, to start a foundation or go to work for someone who's fighting these issues, that takes back that power and grows that strength. So instead of spending a lifetime feeling victimized or fragile or broken, to actually take that and make ourselves stronger. And that's what I want for my children. I mean, so the worry gene in my family grows deep. My grandmother, and my dad, myself, and you know, I can see a little bit in my daughters, but how each generation has modeled for the next generation how to cope with our familial temperaments has improved all of our lives. And so that's so, you know, learning to address our emotional lives is important as learning how to cook or learning how to make the bed or learning how to play a sport, you know, learning to be comfortable with and accept our emotional landscape and to normalize joy and anger and sadness and grief are incredibly important. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. And Annabelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Professor Barrett. How are you?
Good. It's nice to hear from you.
Yeah, it's nice to hear your show every week. I was just calling because, well, first of all, I guess my impression of what trigger warnings originally existed for was for people with severe trauma in areas of, like, sexual assault or domestic violence. So I feel like the way that they have become just a way to avoid any kind of discomfort for anyone, not just people that have gone through severe trauma, is kind of misusing what they were originally meant for.
Mm-hmm.
But then also what you just said about how you're going to have to face that at some point and you're going to have to learn how to handle it, I feel like that's a really important message. And having been in your classes before, I feel like what you do differently than people that just say you can avoid it is you provide a space where you make us uncomfortable, but you also give us a chance to tell you that we're uncomfortable and or even upset, or, you know, I went through that. And so I just feel like that's valuable that you allow us to process the discomfort and feel it, but also communicate it to you.
Well, and maybe that's kind of the message that I'm trying to share with parents is maybe parents themselves are feeling uncomfortable hearing the story. We don't want to know our children are suffering or upset or scared. And so we try to say, don't think about it, or, you know, it'll go away, right? So parents just want our kids to feel okay. So I guess my advantage as a professor is I don't have that vested emotional piece. So I can actually say to you, if you're upset or frightened or concerned about what I'm saying, yes, tell me. And let's see how both of us can grow from this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree with you.
Well, I'm glad you called in. I love hearing your voice.
Yeah, right back at you.
Enjoy your day, Annabelle.
Thanks, you too.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Jackie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about, I have a problem with free-floating anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of anxious situations as an adult. Mostly as an adult, not so much as a young child. And I have what I can't describe as a constant sense of anxiety. The other shoe will drop, or it's not intuitive anymore.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, it was intuitive because I can feel, oh, okay, this is impending or this is something dangerous. But now it just exists within the cells of my body. Mm-hmm. And I have to constantly talk myself out of it and think about, well, why are you having it now? Why is it stronger? You know, sometimes I don't know what it's about anymore. It's so part of my DNA at this point. And I don't know what you have to say about that.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, Jackie, because as I talked about earlier, you know, worries unintended can become disordered or generalized anxiety as we get older, that our body gets so used to that physical response of the fight or flight that it kind of goes there. It becomes a repeated pattern that as soon as we feel, you know, we might even notice that something happened or something, you know, kind of triggered or remember, whatever it is. But we kind of are in that state because our body, it's kind of our fallback state to be in. And so it, as much work as it is, the best long-term kind of help I've seen with generalized free-floating anxiety is the grounding work of meditation, but movement meditation, not sitting. A lot of people with free-floating anxiety can't sit still, but movement, like walking a labyrinth or walking in the forest or, you know, walking the beach, the movement with the breathing and the grounding of the soul, walking barefoot in the beach, anything that kind of brings you into your body are those grounding meditations that can help to break the loop of kind of the free-floating anxiety. Because a lot of times there doesn't have to be something that triggers it after a while. Your body just is comfortable with that state.
Exactly. That's how I feel. So become kinesthetic. Movement is good, in other words.
Huge, huge. And I think a lot of people try to slow down and deep breathe and calm down, and that just makes your heart beat faster. So it's actually what I do with my clients a lot of times is the first thing I'll do is say, let's jump up and down in place for 35 seconds and kind of work with our heart rate and then stop and talk a little bit. But to try to calm down and then talk sometimes does not, it speeds the panic up. So we need to kind of move. We got to work with that energy and move it through our bodies. And then kind of the calm is at the other side.
Thank you. That's the opposite of what I thought. And that's good to know, because I thought if I have this free-floating anxiety, maybe I'm not still enough. But in actuality, what you're saying is that I have to become movement.
Right. Move with it to move it through.
Okay.
Yes. Let me know how it goes. Thanks for calling in, Jackie. Hi, line three is Kathy. I'm sorry, my time is running quick, Kathy, but let's try to hear your story.
Okay, all right, real quick. I have a son who, when he was 1 year old, touched the outside of an oven mm-hmm. and got second-degree burns on his hands. And I've always wondered if that may be why he seems to be kind of more anxious than my other two.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think there might be a connection, do you have any suggestions?
So interestingly enough, it made him more wise and sensitive to the world around him at a young age. In ways I like to say his bubble of of childhood was popped. You know, he experienced pain and fear that a lot of young children don't. So it made him, instead of saying more anxious, I would say more highly sensitized, which in some ways makes him more empathic to the world. And in it all depends on how you process that experience. It either made him more sensitized in a more empathic person. But it doesn't have to be a negative. I think a lot of times we associate sensitivity with negativity. But in some ways, it's actually a positive. And it might mean that he avoids, you know, unconsciously avoids hot things. But it doesn't mean it's a disordered response. It just means that it's a more hyper-aware response to the world around him. And again, I'm all about the movement piece. It's like when he feels a little more anxious to recognize, I wonder where that's coming from. Is this a story right now or is this an old story that I'm experiencing?
Oh, that's fascinating. You really kind of nailed him. I always told people he's an old soul. He seems to know things about the world. Anyway, thank you so much. I appreciate the insight.
Thank you for calling in, Kathy. And Kat, I'm sorry we can't get to you today, but I hope you'll call back next week because, you know, the whole story of anxiety, and you can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, Kat, and love to hear from you, or come to our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. The anxiety story is the biggest story we face in mental health. I wish sometimes I could come every week and have you call in and talk about anxiety because it is the number one driver in the worried well. It's the one thing that we worry most about is my anxiety normal? Is what I'm feeling normal? Am I okay? Which in turn makes us feel a little more anxious. And so if I can leave you with anything today, I want to normalize anxiety as a biological response that's built there to protect us and keep us safe from dangers. What happens in our culture is that we rarely have the downtime to help reset our system. So our emotional system is constantly on high alert, whether it's spending time on your internet or on Facebook or on television or moving 20 miles an hour all day long through your work day or 200 miles per hour. We are in this constant state of stress and movement. And so we go from one, you know, grief or one trauma or one fearful event to another. And we need to have time to settle. We need to have time to settle our nervous system between events. Sleep is so important. Exercising. You got to exercise a little bit every day, at least 30 minutes, that walking meditation. You need to reset your body the way we reset a computer. And that way you can start to feel the normal worries of life and not fall into that bigger disordered way of responding. And this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I appreciate you being a part of this conversation. I hope you'll be part of our pledge drive at kcbx.org. And I look forward to continuing this conversation next week. Thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX.